Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cagliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much.
We are very lucky this episode to have a guest, Dr. Tyson Reeder of the University of Virginia with us. And he is here. He's going to give a talk in about an hour on his new book on smugglers and pirates in the age of revolution. So we want to talk to you about the book and talk about your research generally and talk about your work at the University of Virginia, where you work on the James Madison papers, you know, one of the more important but less illustrious of the founding fathers in the panoply. Agreed. The ones that doesn't get all the fanfare like Frank's man Jefferson. Frank is shaking his head.
Yeah, I'm not sure Madison's less illustrious. I mean,
well, but no, I was thinking about in the public eye, he's not. People think of Washington first, and they think of Jefferson, and then eventually they remember Madison. I think he doesn't get his credit he deserves.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Well, can I also acknowledge that this is especially happy experience for me because Tyson and I are academic siblings.
Academic siblings.
Yes, because we share a PhD advisor in Alan Taylor.
So. These are very complicated genealogies that you're constructing here.
Well, this one's a very
okay. Very good. Fourth cousins twice removed. Okay. Good. So, where did this book project come from? Because it's a very complicated book. It's got, you know, I was just looking at the bibliography, and you're archives all over the places and languages I don't understand, and it seems like it would have been a very complicated book to sort of conceptualize at the beginning. So what's the basic premise of the book, and how did you come up with the start?
Give us the full title first.
Oh, yes.
Full title is Smugglers, Pirates, and Patriots, Free Trade and the Age of Revolution. Yes, this was, and it is a complicated book in a lot of ways, and in a lot of ways coming up with how I wanted to frame an argument was complicated. But I started out really just because I was fluent in Portuguese and Spanish and did pretty good with French, and so I thought, well, you know, it just so happens there's a small piece of the field called Atlantic history that I might be able to work in here with all of these languages. So I wanted to look, I went in with the conception that I wanted to look at connections between the United States, early United States, and Brazil, and had no idea really what I'd find. And it turns out that fortunately I found quite a lot, at least enough to write a book on. So I started to look at commercial connections between the United States and Brazil, and I was a little skeptical about what I'd find because, of course, the Portuguese Empire had closed trade to foreign nations with Brazil until 1808, so I wasn't sure how much commerce I'd find between either, well, early United States or British America, mainland British America. And as I kept digging, though, it turns out that there was a very rich history of smuggling between North America and between the British Atlantic and Brazil, and it came with an entire array of slave smuggling, the slave trade, of gold smuggling, and so there's an entire Atlantic backdrop to early U.S. relations with Brazil that seemed very, very compelling.
Because Americans tend not to, when Americans think of, most Americans think about the early American history, think about the American Revolution, we tend not to, we think about it in terms of an East-West relationships in terms of how to understand what the Revolution means and way to think about Atlantic history. And you've got sort of both a north-south and an east-west dynamic in the matrix, which I think is something that I haven't seen explored nearly as much.
Right. A lot of the historiography that this is based on, I mean, there are historians who have looked north and south, but most of what has been done tends to be comparative. And so we're comparing the British Atlantic with the South Atlantic. And seeing what was different, what was similar, why some empires took some trajectories. And I have some of that in mind. I do end up comparing the British Atlantic with the Portuguese Atlantic and how their differences created different national trajectories for the United States and Brazil. But I mingle the two empires because there was a lot of mingling at the time. So there, to give you an example, the British Americans had a very strong trade with Portugal, and it was a trade where they would send Portugal provisions, and they would receive wine and fruit from Portugal, and that seems like a very easy east-west connection to make, but this came really enveloped with a backdrop of the slave trade, where gold had been discovered in 1695 in Brazil, and so the Portuguese Empire has a strong urge to send more slaves to Brazil so that they can mine Brazilian gold, and that gold is shipped to Portugal, and that gold is then smuggled from Portugal to England, and Portuguese merchants are smuggling that gold so that to England so that they can pay for provisions that they're receiving from North America, so that British North Americans can pay for the dry goods that they're receiving from Great Britain. So just within, you know, within that seemingly straightforward east-west connection between Portugal and British North America, it has an entire backdrop that envelops African trade, which even African trade, it extends beyond Africa into Asia because there are smuggling networks between Asia and Africa. And so all of a sudden we have definitely an Atlantic history and somewhat of a global history happening here.
It's interesting that we're talking about this today, you know, which is celebrated in some parts of the United States traditionally as Columbus Day, but increasingly is recognized as sort of Indigenous Peoples Day or by other names. To think about sort of where Atlantic history comes from as a field and how it's developed over time, because I think Atlantic history has become one of, you know, has over the, I don't know, Frank, when would you create the birth of Atlantic history? 40 years ago?
Well,
I mean, it depends on how one defines it, but it's a field that's a very...
R.R. Palmer's great book, two volumes, the first volume on the Age of Atlantic Revolution, is published in 59. So I suppose the modern incarnation of it goes back to the late 50s, early 60s.
Wow, okay, more than half a century old, okay. But I mean, the field is very much in a different place today than it was then.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think... I'm looking at my shelf here. I don't want to get the date wrong. I mean, I think if you think about, and Tyson will know this as well, David Armitage's book, you know, which really helped define the field in its recent iteration. I think it probably starts with that. Let me get the date right. So, the British Atlantic World.
Frank is pulling a
I'm
book.
Pulling it
I'm
off
narrating,
my shelf. This narrating. Is as it goes. Well, no, so it's the British Atlantic World. It's edited by David Armitage of Harvard and Michael Braddock. And David in that book, and, oh, it's later than I realized, it's 2002. But David has an essay in there called Three Concepts of Atlantic History, which I think really kind of helped define the field in its recent iteration.
Yeah, and I think one thing that Armitage and others... wrote about were some of the problems with Atlantic history as we had currently conceived it, and he said essentially, right. Well, and he essentially said too that when we talk about Atlantic history, we're not talking about Atlantic history. We may be talking about North Atlantic history or South Atlantic history, or, you know, the British Atlantic, but we're not talking about a fully integrated Atlantic. And so I think that's something that I feel like I wanted to contribute to say. We can talk about a true Atlantic, that we don't have to talk about a North Atlantic or South Atlantic, but that these were very, very integrated, and even as empires in some instances tried to shield themselves from inter-imperial influence, those borders were very porous, and you know, traders from North America were smuggling in Brazil. That was difficult until the 1780s and 1790s for British traders to smuggle in Brazil, because they were not only trying to disregard British regular Portuguese regulations, but they had to disregard British and Portuguese regulations by smuggling with Brazil. So it was particularly difficult, but it did happen there. I mean, these boundaries have always been porous. And, you know, I think that was something that I wanted to contribute to in like you said, David, in more of a north-south context than an east-west context.
I mean, you mentioned you have all these language skills, which I'm deeply envious of, but I can imagine that working in archives in all these different places must have caused some problems or challenges.
Well, the first challenge was, you know, my first real research experience was going to, I started this book as my dissertation, and so my first real research experience, besides a couple of jaunts in the Library of Congress when I was doing a master's degree, was my first experience really diving into an archive was going out to Portugal.
Oh, wow.
Right, yeah, and so as a starry-eyed graduate student, you know, I thought I'd, you know, pick up these Portuguese, I knew Portuguese language, but knowing the Portuguese language and reading late 18th century documents in Portuguese is very different. So it was, so that was the first obstacle that I had to overcome, was just being able to actually do the research in the language, which, you know, I spoke enough Portuguese that it came along fine, but it did give me a little bit of a shock at first as I was doing it. But the other thing that gets really complicated is just the historiography, and I would say that's the biggest difficulty. You're not trying to handle, you know, a North American historiography, not even a British Atlantic historiography, but you have to, you know, deal with the South Atlantic historiography, and trying to get those two, well, very many different lines of historiographical thought into communication was very difficult. And part of the difficulty, or part of the different reasons we have so many different strands of historiography between the British Atlantic and the South Atlantic, is because things were different in, if we think of a closed British Atlantic, they did have different conceptions of what free trade was and how it should progress, and North Americans did come up with different ideas about free trade and what it meant for empires, and Brazilians had very different ideas.
So what were those different ideas?
So if we go back to, here we can go back to the American Revolution, where North Americans start to develop a nice syllogism, where independence from Europe equals republicanism, and republicanism equals free trade, and free trade equals prosperity. And so you equate, in the end, independence with free trade. And Brazilians came up with a very different concept in that in the 1790s, let me go back to the 1780s, when there was a small cohort of Brazilians who began to plot rebellions against the Portuguese Empire, and they wanted to declare Brazilian independence, or at least within certain provinces in Brazil, they wanted to declare independence from Portugal. And they actually at one point reached out to Thomas Jefferson, who was in France as the U.S. minister in France at the time, but as these plots begin to unfold in the Portuguese, by 1788, they were really ready to turn one of these plots into a full-grown rebellion and revolution, but the Portuguese government uncovered the plot, it hung and quartered the man principally responsible, Tiradentes, who Tiradentes just... as a fun aside, means tooth puller. He was a part-time dentist, so he got the nickname Tiradentes. Anyway, so he was executed. The other co-conspirators were banished, and their goods were confiscated. And what the Portuguese government realized from this, as they heard testimony after testimony from these plotters who talked about the strong influence of the United States on their ideology, the Portuguese government basically took a step back and said, we need to do something about liberalizing our trade, or else we're going to end up like the British Empire, and we're going to lose our prized colony in Brazil. And so in the 1790s, we see the Brazilian monarchy begin to liberalize trade, and they liberalize principally the African slave trade with Brazil. And they allow even some limited inter-imperial trade with Spanish America. And again, that was mainly in the form of the slave trade, where Brazilians could send slaves, African slaves, to Spanish America in return for Spanish American silver. And so Brazilians, that's a successful approach for the Portuguese government, because Brazilians begin to equate liberalized trade with the monarchy rather than with Republican revolution, unlike in the United States. And so we see these differences in how the Portuguese Empire and the British Empire dealt with that those situations. They affect these national trajectories, and this process is culminated inadvertently in 1808, when Napoleon drives the Portuguese monarchy out of Lisbon. The monarchy crosses the Atlantic and establishes its imperial seat in Brazil. And as a result of that, the monarchy opens all of Brazilian ports to foreign trade. And so again, Brazilians look and say, there's really no, that monarchy and free trade can actually march really in step with each other. And that was a thought process that didn't really occur in the United States. And so this starts to create some really turbulent transnational exchanges between the United States and Brazil, as U.S. smugglers and even pirates, kind of pirates slash privateers, they're privateers with a really shadowy legal status. As they start to go into Brazil and try to open Brazilian ports to the United States, but they're more than trying to trade with Brazil. They're trying to open Brazil up to make it a republic, not a monarchy in the Western Hemisphere. And so there's a lot of miscommunication, we might say, transnational miscommunication between the Portuguese, or I'm sorry, between Brazilians and North Americans about what it means to have free trade and what it means for your political systems.
Huh. So what, my ignorance about pirates is pretty extensive. My knowledge extends probably to Treasure Island and Pirates of the Caribbean. What role did they play in terms of the economic and politics of the Atlantic world?
Right. So this starts to get really complicated, because South American independence is very complicated. But in essence, you have a small region, which is now modern-day Uruguay. At the time, it was called the Banda Oriental. And it's a region that is a border region between Spanish America and Portuguese America. And the two empires had disputed this region really strongly since the 1600s. But in this region, along with Buenos Aires, this region declares its independence from Spain. And yet at the same time, people who live in the Banda Oriental, again, this is modern day Uruguay, they don't really like the centralizing tendencies that they're starting to see out of Buenos Aires either. And so they're actually rebelling against Buenos Aires. At the same time, they're rebelling against the Spanish Empire and the Portuguese government that is seated in Rio by now. This is 1816. Well, between 1811 and 1816 is when a lot of this is occurring in the Banda Oriental. And so by this point, the Portuguese monarchy is seated in Rio rather than in Lisbon, because Napoleon drove it across the Atlantic. And so it starts to look to its southern border and say, well, this is a really good messy opportunity for us to reinsert ourselves into the Banda Oriental and regain control of it from the Spanish Americans. And yet people in the Banda Oriental, Orientales as we call them, they weren't keen on centralization in Spain or Buenos Aires, and they certainly weren't keen on it in Brazil either. So they end up fighting against the Portuguese government. And so the leader of the Orientales, José Hervásio Artigas, begins to recruit North Americans as privateers to prey on Portuguese and Spanish ships for his proto-government, and yet that's just what it was, a proto-government. It hadn't received any recognition from the community of nations, and so these privateers were essentially looked at, for all intents and purposes, as pirates. They didn't actually have legitimate letters of marque from a legitimate government that allowed them to prey on other ships. So they're seen as
Is that pirates. The way they would have seen themselves? As did they realize the papers they were carrying were of dubious merit?
Yeah, they're similar to the privateersmen during the American War of Independence, who, of course, Britain would have considered pirates, but...
Right.
One man's pirate, the other man privateer.
Right? Right. Well, certainly. So a lot of these privateers slash pirates were brought into U.S. courts because they were violating U.S. neutrality laws, right. Also. Mm. And so they are dragged into courts, and so they do make legal, legal arguments that they are legitimate privateers. In some cases, they had actually changed, the captains had changed their nationality like the United Provinces or Colombia or whatever, whatever commission they were holding. But especially in the case of Artigas, that was really dubious, and everybody knew it, because Artigas was such a peripheral figure as far as the revolutions went. It was really hard for him to make a case that he had created a legitimate government in the Bando Oriental. And so this becomes really interesting, because you start to see a disconnect between the U.S. government's goals and the goals of many Americans. A lot of Americans still want to look at Brazil and imagine it not only as somebody that they can trade freely with, but imagine it as a fellow republic or a sister republic. And the U.S. government, however, is trying to make its case to European nations that it can rein in lawlessness among its citizens. They're trying to shore up their reputation among the community of nations so that they can sign advantageous trade agreements. And so the Portuguese government, again, still based in Rio, eventually tells the U.S. government, look, you need to rein in these piracies, or we're not going to, you can forget any sort of advantageous trade agreements with us. And so now the U.S. government has is kind of seeing a real conundrum where a lot of its citizens are cheering on. One editor, William Redding, hails these pirates as Republican pirates, and he wishes them good fortune and hopes that they can repay the atrocities that the Portuguese government is committing against the good Republicans of the Bando Oriental. And yet the U.S. government needs to rein in these pirates slash privateers so that it can come up with free trade, come up with advantageous free trade agreements. And so all of a sudden, it's like the scripts are flipped, where Republican enthusiasm in South America is actually barring the United States from free trade rather than facilitating free trade with the United States. And the government recognizes it, and so it begins to suppress these pirates. So it passes the Piracy Act in 1819, which affects them. It also passes a law in 1820 that bars foreign ships of war from docking in certain U.S. ports, and it was no coincidence that the U.S. ports that law named were the major privateer hubs of like Baltimore, where a lot of Americans were heading out to sail for South Americans.
Really? Okay. I don't tend to think of that many pirates in Baltimore, except when Pittsburgh is in town. And...
Right, right. Well, the historian David Head has written about this. He wrote about this privateering, South American privateering phenomenon, and about the Spanish Empire more broadly. I focus on, for my book, I focus in this chapter on these Artiguan pirates slash privateers.
So these guys are slightly different from the kind of people we associate with, piracy on the Spanish Main and the West Indies, aren't they?
They're
quasi-state actors. It's a question of how legitimate the state they're acting for is, or whether that legitimacy is accepted, right?
Right. That's exactly right. Yes.
This isn't Blackbeard. This is
This is not Blackbeard. Yes. I hope that doesn't disappoint anybody.
Oh, well.
I find these pirates every bit as amazing and fun to study as Blackbeard.
What's the scale of their trade
of what
slash means. Depredations.
Right.
How big is this? How much is it worth? Do you know?
It's hard to put a dollar figure on it, but in terms of Artiguan privateers, I've found about 15 different who were specifically for Artigas. Now there were a lot more that were sailing for Spanish America. Like I said, Colombia, Venezuela, Buenos Aires, they had all recruited North American privateers, and we can assume that all told, You know, we reach into the thousands by the time we consider sailors, captains, networks, you know, privateer sponsors, insurance agents. I mean, we're definitely into the thousands when we're talking about people who were involved in this. And what Artigan, another thing that made Artigan privateers really complicated is the international custom. We can't really talk about international law, but international custom at the time was that a privateer cannot hold commissions from two different nations. And most of these Artigan privateers held a commission from both Buenos Aires and then another from Artigas. And or from, you know, sometimes from Venezuela.
Why not? Why couldn't you hold commit? Why can't you be a, like an Uber driver who's also a
Lyft driver?
Right. Exactly.
The thinking really came down to that really crosses a line into piracy. That you don't have a national affiliation with that country. That you're just kind of, you know, you can't be a free agent, violent marauder on the seas who's just up for hire.
Because then you are really beyond the law.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. The if you're sailing for one nation, you have some sort of national affiliation with that nation. Otherwise, you're just a mercenary. And by the early 1800s, international law, European nations are really starting to try to control private violence in favor of state-sponsored violence. What we get into Max Weber's idea of a state monopoly on the legitimate means of violence, and they start to try to rein in any sort of private violence that they had once sponsored, but now they... Even privateering, we see, starts to go by the wayside. Legitimate privateering starts to go by the wayside about this time in favor of navies, state-sponsored navies.
What's the background of the people who are, people who are doing the smuggling and people who are engaged in piracy and people who are engaged in this kind of Atlantic world commerce that's slightly both legal and illegal, depending on one's perspective? Who's getting involved in this? Where are they, these people coming from?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And the answer, as you may expect, is that they're very diverse. But we see them come, a lot of the sailors, there's kind of a difference between captains and sailors. So a lot of the captains who are getting involved are those who have been fairly prominent captains up until the 1850s, and one reason that they jump into the private, you know, this dubious privateering business after the War of 1812 is that that's what they've been doing for the U.S. government during the War of 1812, and now all of a sudden their business is kind of at an end with the end of that war. It's what they're good at, right? Okay. And so now their business is coming to an end, and it's a business that served them well. And so we see some fairly prominent privateer captains who jump from privateering for the U.S. government into privateering for South Americans. In terms of the sailors, you might get drunk one night and sign on the wrong dotted line and find yourself on a privateer ship the next morning. But even more than that, what I focus on in my book is what I call border waters. And the idea is that while they're out on the high seas, these privateers are creating polyethnic crews by integrating those whom they capture. And the most vulnerable among those whom they capture are Africans, or people of African descent, sometimes slaves, sometimes free African sailors, but they tend to be the most vulnerable. And so they begin to incorporate a lot of blacks into their crews, and along with some Portuguese whites. Sometimes they take them captive and adopt them into their crews. Sometimes they go willingly. We know that some African slaves and some what are called grumetis, who are Africans, Luso Africans, who are sailing for the Portuguese for Portuguese commerce, but they're in a really vulnerable position. They're working for low wages, serving the captain. So some of them decide to go aboard these privateers, and basically, you know, the idea is that hopefully, you know, they'll have more freedom aboard a privateer than they do aboard their ships. And now sometimes it's, you know, evidence indicates that they probably may have faced a lot of vulnerability once they were on these privateers. This evidence starts to... It's a little bit difficult to pin down, and to give an example, I'll tell you about Henry Ford, who was a captain of a U.S. privateer. He incorporated about 12 blacks onto his ship, and they seem, according to... When Henry Ford was taken for slave smuggling, he was captured for slave smuggling, for smuggling these 12 blacks into the United States. This is, of course, after the United States has prohibited international imports of slaves. And so Henry Ford is on trial for slave smuggling, and yet his crew, as the prosecutors are asking his crew about these 12 blacks whom he supposedly smuggled into the United States, the crew said, no, they weren't slaves. They were fighting along with the rest of us. They received rations like the rest of us. They were like any other crew members. So they were not slaves. They weren't smuggled into the United States. But it still remains that apparently as soon as he docked in Baltimore, those slaves or those black sailors vanish. And certainly the U.S. government suspected that he had smuggled them in, and so maybe he did and maybe he didn't. We don't actually know the final verdict of what happened to Henry Ford in that case. We don't know. We just don't have enough evidence to know what exactly he did with those slaves. But in other instances, some of these pirates would capture Portuguese slave vessels. So you don't just have slaves who are, or blacks who are manning the vessels, but you have slaves who are in the hold.
Who are the cargo.
Yeah. And those we can almost certainly suppose were smuggled, either smuggled into the United States or sold in the Caribbean.
Huh. It reminds me of sort of the racial dynamics on whaling vessels, which would also be lying the same waters, where the clear cut lines between who is free and who is enslaved, and you know, between different races, is much more malleable on the water than it is on the land.
Right, and that's a really good word for it. It was very malleable. It was very fluid. And
fluid on the water.
Yeah, right? Fluid on the water. That's right. Yes, and. Here I draw on John Torpy's work that the United States, or the modern governments, early modern governments, are trying to establish a monopoly on the legitimate means of movement in addition to the legitimate means of violence. So they are starting to try to control movement in and out of their borders, starting to be more rigorous about issuing passports and crew lists and things like that. And so when you have these polyethnic crews on the waters, Portuguese ambassadors start to use that against the United States and say, look, they're defying U.S. law. You need to rein them in because they're making a mockery of your government. And they're not members of any nation. They're certainly not members of the United States. You know, they're not citizens of the United States. And if they are, they're not acting like it. And that was a real blot on the United States. One agent, he wasn't Portuguese. He was actually an American who was... commissioned by the Portuguese government to go down into the Caribbean and investigate some of this piracy / privateering. And he wrote a very scathing report about these privateers, and that they were people of mixed races, and they came from every nation under the globe, and yet they were principally sponsored by American networks. And so this was a stain on the United States. And so it starts to be used against the United States to pressure the United States to rein in piracy.
So what's the main argument of the book? What's the main takeaway you want readers to bring with them when they finished it?
Yeah, the main argument is that these turbulent the differences between the British and Portuguese empires, the differences in how they handled revolution and free trade, created these really turbulent transnational exchanges between the United States and Brazil, and that by the Civil War, because of these different trajectories, by the time of the Civil War, the United States people, Americans, North Americans, no longer see Brazil as a sister republic, or even a country that's going to become a sister republic. It's seen as a fellow slave power. And so what this book does is it sheds light on the really the myth that Americans had created of the idea of a Republican hemisphere in the West, and that as that at every turn, really, Brazil unmasked that concept for the myth that it was.
Interesting. Well, we look forward to hearing you speak in a few minutes, but we recommend the book to all of our listeners.
Yes.
Yeah, who's your publisher?
University of Pennsylvania Press.
Excellent.
Good. All right.
Now, your day job. Your role at the University of Virginia is as one of the editors of the James Madison papers.
Right.
Which is, I think documentary editing certainly is something that will be of interest to a lot of our listeners. I know that I've benefited greatly from the labors of documentary editors, so I look to you and say thank you on behalf of not just yourself, but your craft or your your guild.
Right, yes.
So can you tell us a little, how did you get into that, and what's it like working on such a massive project?
Yeah, well, this is another area where my languages became beneficial in that I specifically am working on the Secretary of State series for James Madison, and so of course he's receiving correspondence from all over the globe, and so languages come in very useful. I mean, they're more than useful; they're a necessity, at least in the series that I'm working on. So I really fell into this more or less by accident when, you know, I found that there was the University of Virginia was looking for somebody who could read French and Spanish and who had experience working in the wider Atlantic and U.S. international relations, and I thought, well, I happen to know somebody who does that. So it was more or less by accident, but it really is a... it's a very distinct way to carve out a profession as a historian, but it's a very fulfilling. It's a very fulfilling way. Sometimes it can be very mundane. You're looking at, you know, the most mundane of all documents. But then every now and then you frequently come across some really interesting aspects of even in the life of James Madison, who has been thoroughly studied, but. Particularly during his Secretary of State years, Madison tends to be skipped over in favor of Jefferson. I mean, for obvious reasons, Jefferson is the president, but not a lot of historians have spent a lot of time on James Madison. And, you know, it's kind of by the way, he was Secretary of State, and then he became president and entered, you know, got the United States into this foolish war. And so to really dig into his Secretary of State series and understand James Madison as the chief diplomat of the United States is really, you know, it's a great experience. You come across new aspects of James Madison that haven't been written before. I recently was in Lisbon and uncovered some documents from James Madison to the Portuguese chargé d'affaires. So even in a life as well covered as Madison, there were still documents out there in some of these foreign archives that we have not. I mean, certainly archivists, you know, had cataloged them and so on, but they were unknown really to historians.
So how did then go about finding these things in these scattered archives all over the world?
Well, this was really fortuitous in that. I was in Lisbon and I went into their, they have what's called the Ministerio de Negocios Extranjeros, which is their foreign ministry archive. So I got looking through their records and I, you know, thought, well, if I was going to find, according to, you know, reading through their guides,
Finding aids,
thank you, is the word that I'm looking for. Looking through their finding aids, you know, they didn't list every Madison document, but, you know, I just kind of looked at the general description and thought, well, if I was going to find any Madison documents, I guess they'd be in here. And so it is a really, you know, it's a refreshing experience to go out and, you know, to scour these foreign archives. And sometimes you'll find things that, you know, maybe we had a record of before, maybe Madison had kept a record in his letter book, but every now and then, like I said, you know, I came across these letters that historians had never seen from Madison before. So it was really it was a unique find in that there was a pretty good handful of Madison documents that we hadn't known about at the Madison papers. And then at other times, you come across an aspect of Madison that maybe has been written about but kind of glossed over, and this leads me into what I'm actually writing in on my next book on, which is foreign meddling in early America, as I've been editing Madison's papers. I found a really interesting episode between him and the Marquis de Caserujo, who was the Spanish ambassador to the United States, who Madison, at one point Madison wrote a 34-page indictment against Caserujo for trying to meddle in U.S. politics through the free press. And at one point in this 34-page document, he has this, you know, really biting line that now Madison is imminently unquotable, so anytime that you quote Madison, you know, I mean, he didn't have a way of summing things up very nicely, but he in essence said in about a full paragraph, what would become of U.S. democracy if we allowed U.S. agents to meddle in U.S. politics and bias U.S. elections? And of course, I'm reading that.
Not U.S. agents, but foreign agents.
Oh, I'm sorry, foreign agents. Okay. Yes, foreign agents. What would happen if we allowed foreign agents to meddle in U.S. Elections and bias U.S. elections? And of course, that rang very familiar. And so, you know, I started to look deeper into this exchange between Madison and Irujo. And I'm now starting my next book, which is on early foreign meddling in early American politics.
So what would, were we to revive James Madison today, what would he say about the current political situation?
So in his dealings with the Marquis de Caserujo, this becomes very interesting, I think, with James Madison. We have to go back to the... Alien and Sedition Acts, I think. When Madison is railing against, especially the Sedition Act, that is reining in the free press, that doesn't allow the press to scandalize the president, or and Madison, of course, writes the Virginia Resolutions, where he excoriates the Sedition Act. And then, however, he starts, when he becomes Secretary of State, the Marquis de Caserujo begins to use the free press to try to upset Federalists against the Jefferson administration and influence U.S. policy, basically by not by directly scheming against it, but by trying to rally Federalist allies against it, or Jefferson's Federalist foes against it. And so Madison now has this sort of conundrum where he's really the defender, one of the main defenders of the U.S. free press. And yet that very press is allowing a foreign agent to meddle in the administration, Jefferson's administration. And so Madison is in a little bit of a bind, and he writes to in this indictment that I mentioned against Caserujo, he says that Irujo is corrupting the presses. And that's a little bit tricky because, of course, Irujo is really just trying to rally Jefferson's Federalist foes against the administration. And so Madison seems to be equating corruption with dissent with corruption. He's equating the two in some ways. And so he doesn't seem as keen on the free press now that he's Secretary of State and realizes that it actually does make governing very difficult when you have a very unwieldy free press that can say whatever it wants about the administration.
Sounds very familiar.
Right, yeah. Right. And yet, Madison and Jefferson choose not to do anything to, you know, like reinstate their own version of the Sedition Acts, and especially Madison. Madison's administration, we don't need to get into all of the messy details, but by about 1810, the Supreme Court is trying to decide if it should prosecute some editors who had committed libel against the Jefferson administration. And the Madison administration chooses not to contest this in the Supreme Court. They just let it go. And so in 1810, in the case of Hudson, I believe it's Hudson versus the United States, is really when the Supreme Court says common law cannot regulate the free press. The press is free and you can't try to regulate it on the basis of common law. And so Madison, all of this is to say that Madison never tries to reinvent the Sedition Acts or institute his own version of the Sedition Acts to rein in his political enemies. And instead, he really focuses on foreign ambassadors. And when I look at that, in some ways, I think that that can be a very productive way to consider how we're dealing with foreign influence. That just like in Madison's time, a lot of the foreign meddling that is occurring from Russia and so forth has to do with foreign agents who are basically trying to stir up division in U.S. politics. And that as that division continues to grow, it exacerbates U.S. politics, and that makes it even easier for foreign agents to meddle in U.S. politics. And so to stop the cycle, James Madison, rather than try to criminalize his political opponents, he basically said, we want to focus on foreign agents and put, you know, basically in his conception, the United States should rally against foreign agents who are trying to meddle in U.S. elections rather than turn on one another and point fingers at one another about who is or who isn't meddling in foreign elections. I mean, there's a lot more complicated stories about that as regards Madison. But
right. Well, I wish we could talk about that for the next hour, but unfortunately, we need to run. Yes. Or fortunately, we need to run so we can have you give a talk about your book and to a bunch of students who are waiting downstairs for us.
All right.
But thank you so much for coming and talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Tyson.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.